Well, hey, cousins, you are listening to Revolutionary Hood Rat with Kim Young of Dope Black Social Worker, and welcome back. Welcome back. I'm also just going to welcome myself back. And look, I apologize if I sound a little bit different. Your cousin is still trying to recover from my trip to New Orleans, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But you got me for the whole episode. There's no guests. It's just me and you kicking it this time. And so let's go ahead and get started with the revolutionary news for the week, which goes out to the social work class of 2025. Y'all, I know that school is getting started for a lot of folks across the country. Students are returning to campus, moving back in, prepping for their first days of class. So are professors and faculty and staff getting ready to welcome students into their programs. And I just want to take a moment to let the graduating class of 2025, as well as the new students who are coming onto campuses, entering programs, getting ready to find their way throughout their social work journey and education, welcome. We're so happy that you're here. And please understand that you are not alone. And I'm specifically talking to Black and Brown social work students. There are going to be a lot of challenges that you may have already encountered or you have yet to discover that are awaiting you as you begin this journey or continue this journey to get your social work education. And I want you to know that you don't have to be strong through those things, but you also are not alone through those things, meaning there are other people that I want you to lean on, build your village, find your village in school of support to help you get through those really difficult moments where you may start to believe and think and feel that you don't belong, right? Believe and think and feel that this profession or social work is not for you. All of that is false. You belong here. We need you here. And even though you may look to your right and look to your left and look in front of you in terms of who your instructors are, and those people may not look like you, you are needed. We need you. This field needs you. You belong in the work. And don't feel like you have to walk through this journey alone. You don't. And so you can lean on the village that you build directly, lean on the village that maybe you build in the social media networking spaces, but just find your people, find your cousins. I got your back and I'm rooting for you. I truly am. And so shout out to the social work students who are beginning this journey. Shout out to the social work students who are ending this journey this academic year. I am so excited for y'all, so excited for your futures. And I'm really, really hopeful and excited about this field of social work and all that is going to continue to grow and be and lean into its true purpose. And so shout out to y'all. I'm rooting for you, truly, truly. Let's go ahead and get into some Earth is Ghetto for the week. And let me go ahead and break down why I probably sound like this. Y'all, I'm bullshitting. I'd have been back for a couple of days from New Orleans or whatever, but let me tell you something. That is not the city you go to where you're like, oh yeah, I'm gonna get me a little bit of rest. I'm eating a little bit of food and having a little bit of cocktails, walk around, make some friends, this and the third. Y'all, I was out there acting like I was young again when I am not. I am older. Body aging, legs aging, back aging, mind aging, but the turnip stays the same. And so I had the opportunity to visit New Orleans, and I mentioned that to y'all during the last episode, how I do want to make it just kind of a real effort to get to New Orleans every year because it always just feels good. But this particular trip was different. It was my friend's birthday, and so it was three social workers took over New Orleans. And if you ain't ever been on vacation with a group of social workers, I highly recommend it because it's like a collective of people who have just, you know, we're highly skilled in the art of communication. We have a lot of social skills. We know how to make friends. We know how to perceive threats or danger. We know how to get things for free. We know how to finesse shit. Like, it's just a really solid group of people to be out in the world with. Have a lot of basic skills, advanced skills, all these necessary skills you need to have a good ass time and make it home safe. Baby, social workers are the person or the people that you need to be around if you're trying to have a good time. And so while in New Orleans, though, we did end up running into this event. Never heard of it before. We found out the day before it happened. It was on the Saturday that they were there. It's called the Red Dress Run, if I'm not mistaken. So the way it was explained to us on Friday, when we was out just kind of bar hopping, which, by the way, my friend got a whole proposal on Friday. Shawty made her a ring out of a napkin. I said, oh, this ring is beautiful. Tiffany's could never, right? Like, this bitch, girl, this ring is beautiful. Go ahead and marry that man. But anyways, after the proposal on Friday, we met a bartender who was telling us this story, not even telling us the story. He was telling us about this event that was about to take over the entire city called the Red Dress Run. And so, like, 100,000 plus people were in New Orleans, all wearing red dresses. But here's the thing: apparently, it's supposed to be a fundraiser and an actual like race where like people have on racing bibs and they are like running and shit. But these hoes turned this thing into an entire party. Like, they shut down the entire French quarters. People were decked out in some of the most beautiful red gowns, so much tulle and organza and satin flowing with some polyester as well. But the fabrics were beautiful. The people were beautiful, regardless of your gender identity or expression. Everybody had a dress on. I saw a lot of ass. Well, actually, everybody did not have a dress on because there was a lot of ass out too. Some people was just, advertising what they had to offer up to the world and was like, I ain't got time to put no dress over this body because you're going to see this body. And so people were just in a good mood. Spirits were high. It just felt like community. It felt warm. Folks were having a good time and partying at the same time. There were also parents had brought their kids out there. The babies were out there once again of all gender identities and expressions, like decked down in their red dresses. Even had to crack, even was able to crack open a fire hydrant. Like, kids were playing in the water because you already know New Orleans is incredibly hot. And then people were just out there bar crawling, walking around, hyping each other up. Like, oh, baby, I love that dress. Oh, I love how you did that. Oh, let me get a picture. Like, just hyping people up, having such a great time. And here we go. One of my friends wearing bright ass green. Another friend got on black and animal print. And me, I got on black and white from head to toe. And so we didn't blend in at all, which means we had to stand out in personality. And trust me, we had that covered 100%. But New Orleans was a great time. It's one of those cities where truly, like, no matter where you go, you're gonna find a vibe, you're gonna get something good to eat. And if you get down with spirits and libations, you can get a solid spirit of libation in most of the spots in New Orleans. And I absolutely cannot wait. I cannot wait to go back next year. I also made an effort because one of my friends has sent me the video of Mr. Ron Hubbard talking about his bed and breakfast that he has in New Orleans called Hubbard Mansion. The cutest, sweetest, elderly black man. He was like, come on down and visit me if you ever in the city. Stop by and say hello. I said, oh my God, y'all, I gotta go try to say hi to Mr. Ron. And so definitely made that pilgrimage out to the Hubbard house to say hi to Mr. Ron. But Mr. Ron was not home. And so I did not get to see him, but I was able to, be nosy, look in the windows, but also take some pictures. The Hubbard house is the second Black-owned mansion in that particular neighborhood in New Orleans. And so it's a big deal. It was major. So I said, I have to go try and see the house and say hi to Mr. Ron. So, but I didn't get to do that. But next year, when I make my pilgrimage and journey, excuse me, back out to New Orleans, I'm definitely going to try again to swing by the Hubbard Mansion and say hello to Mr. Ron. Do you know, while I was in New Orleans, it seemed like every other Black person in the whole United States was in Martha's Vineyard. And I was like, I should have been in Martha's Vineyard. And then I also started to think about my memories of Martha's Vineyard, which are very limited. Like, I didn't grow up on the East Coast. And so Martha's Vineyards wasn't really a thing that I understood. I honestly, no bullshit, I associated Martha's Vineyard with Martha Stewart. I was like, oh, like, I guess she just owned the whole thing or some shit. Like, maybe every bed and breakfast has all of her, cooking equipment and linens inside of it. I don't really know, but I didn't really have, a context for Martha's Vineyard growing up. But now that I've been over on this side of the country for so long and I see all these Black folks that just kind of take a whole week and just be in Martha's Vineyards wearing white linen, walking around. I said, I think as I kind of, sail closer into my auntie era, oh, your girl gonna have to make this pilgrimage up to Martha's Vineyard and see what's going on. I'm gonna have to go see what's going on in Martha's Vineyard. Do you know something else that we got to see about? Has anybody seen Joe Biden? It seems like ever since Robinette stepped aside from the presidential election, we ain't seen Joe too much, or I ain't seen Joe too much. I didn't see a whole lot of Kamala. I've seen a little bit of 45. Seen a whole lot of from the windows to the walls, right? The VP that Kamala selected, and that announcement of what's his name, Tim Walz, as the VP candidate. The way the internet took that over, and the way that Black folks were so quick to call that man Waltz. And the only reason I believe that I'm able to make an association and say his name correctly is because somebody on the internet was like, say it with me, y'all. It's just the way little John said, from the windows to the wall. It's the same thing with this man. From the windows to the walls. Walls. His last name is Walls, not Waltz. So I'm not even gonna hold you. That is the only reason I know how to pronounce and say this man's name correctly, or else I would also say Waltz. But I ain't seen Joe in a month of Sundays. So we'll see what's going on with all this. I know what we're moving closer to the convention, and then there's a debate coming up in September, which that's gonna be some good TV. I'm not even a big fan of Saturday Night Live, but they getting ready to show their ass. Like, Saturday Night Live is about to be good all the way through November. And I'm kind of excited to see what all that is about. Truly excited to see what all that is about. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about, I don't know if anybody is familiar with Cam Newton. Cam Newton is a former NFL quarterback. He played for the Carolina Panthers for a while. I think he also went over to the Patriots for a little bit. And then, his career took a turn and he was just out of the league at an age when honestly, he still had potential and abilities to compete in the league as a quarterback. And I just want to tell y'all right now, I knew all that shit off the dome. I didn't have to look that up because your girl knows a little bit about sports ball. But Cam also has this YouTube series and a podcast that he's been doing for quite some time now. And he's had a number of pretty solid guests come and chit and chat with him while he's, drinking a little cognac, smoking a little cigar at his restaurant in Atlanta. And this guest that he had this week was Kirk Franklin. And before I even get into the conversation that Cam had with Kirk Franklin and some of the things that I was kind of paying attention to throughout their time together, it's like, yo, Cam Newton is a solid interviewer. Like, he really knows how to listen with the intent of not responding, but listen to be present, listen to offer compassion, listen to offer understanding, listen because he's curious and interested in the subject matter and the person that he's talking to. And I haven't noticed that just with Kirk Franklin. I've noticed that with his other interviews as well. It's like, no, like, this man, beyond just having a team that helps to prep him for these conversations, pre-production notes or whatever, like, he is genuinely interested in the lives and the things that the people sitting across from him have going on. And he has compassion and critical thinking to offer to a conversation that really guides it in ways that I haven't really seen from some of these other, professional athletes turned interviewers, podcasters. Many of them have a hard time actually being in conversation and communicating. They ask questions, but it seems like they'd be so focused on their next question where they don't listen to responses and actually know how to be in the moment with somebody and use that response as a leverage for, additional questions that may or may not have been prepped. But Cam Newton, he got that shit down. And that just kind of shows me that he's just naturally inquisitive and naturally attuned to the emotion, his own emotions and other people's emotions. So that aside, this conversation with Kirk Franklin, I'm not sure how much y'all are kind of aware of Kirk revealing some of his most recent stories and things happening in his life, but I think it might have been last year he put out that documentary on YouTube about it's called Fatherhood, and it is about his journey, just from like being a child, not raised by his mother, not knowing who his father was, in a small town, all of the trauma that comes with that, the confusion, the loneliness that comes with that, the addiction that comes with that. I'm talking about like sexual addiction. From my recollection, he didn't have any substance use, but he did have a porn addiction. But all these things that kind of come with a traumatic childhood and upbringing and secrets and lies and deception from a very young age all the way into your adulthood. Also dealing with a birth mother who cannot be honest and true with you about who you are, what she knows, and who your father is. Right. And so in this documentary that Kirk released last year, and it is available on YouTube if you want to watch it, he finds out at his very big age that the man he thought was his father is not actually his father. And his actual father is a man that grew, that was living down the street from him all throughout his life. And he found this out through DNA testing and through word of mouth around town that was like, hey, this actually might be the person that's your daddy. And then ended up getting the DNA test. It was proven that that man was his dad. And then when Kirk went to go approach his mother about the information, his mother sat across from him and was like, this is a lie. Like, the DNA test is lying. This is not true. That's not your dad. I don't know what you're talking about. All of this is not true. And so Kirk was just like, what? Like, how can you sit across from me? This, like, how can you do this? And so I'm sharing a little bit of that backstory to understand that Kirk is dealing with a lot of complex issues, a lot of complex trauma, a lot of things that are woven together, a lot of just a lack of understanding and foundation of who he is, which has kind of left him flailing in the world, make it difficult for him to be in relationship with himself, with his wife, with his kids, with other people. But for him, he says continuously, like, he has found savior and solace in gospel music and in the church, right? He uses gospel music to communicate to God. He uses gospel music to communicate with his family, with whomever. He just uses the music to communicate because he has struggled with that in the past. He has so many struggles to the point where, you know, he shared in the documentary, but he also shared in conversation with Cam Newton that Kirk Franklin has been in therapy with the same therapist for over a decade. And when I heard it the first time, I was like, what in the entire hell? You've been in talk therapy with the same therapist for over a decade and we're still here? Like, we're still having these same challenges and struggles and things are not improving at a rate that should happen after a decade plus of talk therapy with the same therapist. Now, I'm not talking about like having the same psychiatrist, you know, a prescribing physician for your psychiatric meds. Like, that's a different relationship. My mind can understand having the same prescribing physician for the rest of your life. My mind can understand that. My mind cannot comprehend why the entire hell this man has had and been in talk therapy for over a decade with the same therapist and things are not getting better at the rate that they should get better. And so this led me down the whole rabbit hole that I have been going down in the platform and, you know, some shit I'll stand 10 toes down on for a minute now. Is it really feels like where we are in this moment in time and like mental health and behavioral health, access to talk therapy, private practice, outpatient therapy, all of these things, it's almost like there's this new addiction to therapy that has formed since the pandemic. Where we keep hearing the message like everybody needs therapy, everybody needs to go to therapy, you know, all this bullshit that is not true. Everybody does not need therapy. Everyone does not need to go to therapy. Nobody without a severe mental health illness, like a, you know, like a true SMI, needs to be in therapy for over a goddamn decade. Therapy is not the end all be all. Therapy, you go, you get your skills, you get the tools, you practice them, you reflect, you move through some of the murkiness that has been clouding your life, making it difficult for you to see possibilities, your strengths, make decisions, like all this type of shit, right? And you go practice that stuff in real time in life. You come check in therapy. We trying to step you down. So maybe I was seeing you at twice a week. Now we at 1 week. Now we from once a week to every other week. Now we from every other week to a month. Now from every month to every other month. And now we getting to the point we got some quarterly check-ins, biannual check-ins, and then you is gone. Out of here. Go practice the things that we have been working through in this office in your real life. But for you to be coming to me, and keep in mind, I have not even said this part. Kirk goes to see his therapist 2 to 3 times a week. Baby, that smells like codependency for both of them. I am growing overly concerned with like this addiction to therapy that is occurring and this codependency that is occurring between the therapist and the individual receiving therapy. Because this is absolutely wild. And he's not alone. There are a number of celebrities that I have heard kind of talk about therapy and their therapist as a friend that they check in with, a friend that's like the barometer. Your therapist is not your friend. A therapist is not a friend. And if a therapist is crossing a line into being a friend while they are actually your therapist, we got a problem. There is a true codependency that I believe that is occurring between outpatient, private practice, talk therapist, psychotherapist, and these clients that they have long-term relationships with, that they have not began to reduce the number of sessions and put more of the onus onto their client to then practice these skill sets that are happening in the office and their real life. That also may speak to the inability of some psychotherapists to actually transfer the knowledge and skills to their clients. Oh. Yo, that shit, that messed my head up yet again. Even though I remember this man said that in that documentary, how he goes to therapy 2 to 3 times a week and has been in therapy for over a decade with the same therapist. Y'all, this is not okay. If you hear somebody talking like this, this is not okay. If you yourself are talking like this as a psychotherapist, as a full-time outpatient therapist, this is not okay. Being in a relationship with a client for multiple years without seeing improvements in their wellness, their behaviors, that says a lot about the therapist, honestly. Because the client gonna react how a client gonna react because they're still trying to work through some things, learn a new way to experience this world, experience themselves, think through, solve problems, make decisions, regulate their nervous systems and emotions, deal with their trauma. The client gonna react how they should be expected to react. But as the trained professional to allow that bullshit to continue to happen for years, for weeks and weeks at a time without seeing some level of improvement, that to me speaks to deficits within the therapist and that therapist not being honest with the client that this may not be a good match. I may not either be the correct therapist for you right now, or this may not be the right time for you to be in therapy right now. Because the way this therapist needs to go ahead and let Kirk Franklin's ass go, 10 years of 2 to 3 times a week, I know the money good. I get it. We all in capitalism. We got to get the bag how we can get it. So I know the money good. And I know it ain't even no goddamn insurance. It's cash. Kirk is paying out the pocket 2 to 3 times a week. So I get the therapist. It's like, yeah, come on back. Keep coming, baby. Because your money good. Your green money is good here. Keep coming. But this therapist needs to absolutely discharge Kirk Franklin's ass. He needs to go. He needs to go. This is a problem. This is a crisis in the field, truth be told. This idea of pushing everybody into therapy when they express some sort of emotional, behavioral, or mental discomfort is a problem. We are already dealing with an over-reliance on a failing system or on an overstressed and overworked system with a workforce that is diminishing every single day. So to continue to push everybody into therapy when therapy is not the end-all be-all, nor is it always the first option for people, there are lower levels of intervention and care that we need to begin to put back into our mindsets that people can get access to without having to go the formal route of a psychotherapist. That's where we are failing in community. That's where we're not doing that good, the necessary part of community care for ourselves and each other, and be so quick to like, oh, you need to go talk to the lady. Everybody don't gotta go talk to the lady, to the man, to who, to him, to whomever. There are other options available. But 10 years, 2 to 3 times a week, the way I would be tired of seeing that man. If you don't get out my face and go practice and do these things that we've been talking about for the last decade, oh my God, get out of here. I just had to get that one off my chest because it really is starting to feel like an addiction to therapy. And there's this high level of codependency that is occurring between therapists and clients, especially their long-term clients, that people are just not paying attention to. It's not normal. I'm sorry, y'all. It's not normal to be in psychotherapy for this many years without like an SMI. It's just, this is not normal. And the system is not built for it to sustain. It cannot sustain this way. People have to roll out of therapy, talk therapy, psychotherapy, outpatient therapy, so others can roll in. But if people are holding on to clients for financial reasons or for codependency reasons, then we are in for a shitty, 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 shitty future as a, as a discipline, as a profession, that one of the things we offer is therapy. I'm gonna leave it right there. I'm gonna leave it right there. But before I get into Tales from the Trap, I do want to take a moment to just talk about and talk to Dr. Stacey Hardy Chandler. So Dr. Stacey Hardy Chandler is the Chief Executive Officer, CEO of the Association of Social Work Boards. And so the ASWB is the organization that administers all of the examinations that social workers take in order to gain licensure across the country, some provinces in Canada, and a few US territories. And so they're responsible for administering the clinical exam, the generalist exam for master's level social workers, and the generalist exam for bachelor's level social workers. And if folks have been around me for a while or in the work for a minute, especially since 2022, when they released that data pass rate analysis of these ASWB exams, which essentially just came and told the truth that many, way before me have known for a while and have been calling for data transparency from the ASWB to show that Black, Brown, older, English as a second language, and those with learning needs struggled the most to pass the exam. Meaning, like, Black folks had one of the lowest exam pass rates out of all demographic groups that took the clinical or the generalist exam. And so, what we have seen happen across the country since 2022 is a call to really take a look at this process of how somebody is able to gain access to social work licensure. Because as we know with social work licensure, then that opens up the doorway to employment opportunities, higher paying jobs, jobs that are considered more safe, jobs that have a better trajectory or just have a clearer kind of vision on what is possible for you. And how many people are left out of getting access to that because they cannot pass a test. Right. And so we see a lot of Black and Brown folks, a lot of older folks in the field staying in these low wage jobs because they cannot pass these examinations, which then give them access to licensure, which then gives them access to a whole new set of employment opportunities. And so we have seen states across the country just kind of come together and like challenge this process of like, hey, we got to do something different because this is not working. And that different has looked like trying to eliminate the examinations in some states, also trying to create these alternative pathways like we did in Virginia. And we're going to do this upcoming session of just giving people options that you can opt into taking the test, or here's this other path where you don't have to take this exam at all. Now, it is important to remember like social work licensure was not always like this. We always did not have examinations, we always did not have the ASWB. Right. And there are organizations like the National Association of Black Social Workers who have been against social work examination from the beginning because they knew what this would do, especially to Black social workers. They knew this would exclude us from leadership, from high paying jobs, from opportunities. They knew exactly what happened. And so I'm bringing all of this up because Dr. Stacey Hardy Chandler released a newsletter on July 23rd entitled Ubuntu in Action, Understanding Past Rates. And so if anybody is not familiar with this phrase Ubuntu, it's a philosophy that comes out of South Africa specifically, if I'm not mistaken, but it has this idea of like, I am because we are, right? Like I see you, you see me, we're interconnected. We have this bonding with each other because we are both human, having a human experience together. So I am because you are. Collectively, we are together. And so this newsletter is titled Ubuntu in Action, Understanding Past Rates. And I'm bringing this up and I wanna encourage people, like go read this newsletter. Please like read it, form your own thoughts and opinions, sit with it for a moment. You can find it on the ASWB's website under news releases or something like that, if I'm not mistaken. But I wanna read this section out of the newsletter where Dr. Stacey writes, and you know, the subheading is drafting away from Ubuntu. And it says, during the past 2 years, some within social work's own family have taken up the mantle of division rather than seeking collaboration. On the pretense that ignores the systems and institutions that impact us all, including licensure candidates, some across the profession and state legislators, and even within the regulatory space, have taken a reductionist approach in response to the disparities in exam outcomes. They reacted swiftly, calling the licensing exam themselves flawed and advocating for removing the key component of competence assessment from the licensure system. This approach is dangerous. One for our own profession, as it leads us further away from cohesive professional identity and risks distracting us from the true challenges that we must face together. This section goes on to further say, the reality is that outcomes are not origins. That conflation of the two contradicts our understanding of systemic impacts. Competence exams do not cause disparities. They reflect the same impacts of generations of oppression and marginalization that we see in every other aspect of life. Social work is not immune from the historical realities at play in other corners of modern society. There's more. There's more that happens within this article that left me feeling so sad for Dr. Hardy Chandler. Because as a Black woman in a leading one of the big three organizations for this really massive profession of social work, to have to mask in this way, to have to use our culture, our identity, our values in a way that turns it against its own people is sad to me. To use Ubuntu as a way to essentially tell people who are advocating and pushing for a more inclusive and equitable profession to stop bullying us, that we need to come together and work together, and that we are not the ones that are behaving as an oppressor, but more or less you all are for not wanting to collaboratively work with us. It's some bullshit. This is sad, and this is some bullshit. Like, and it doesn't have to necessarily be this way. These examinations absolutely are oppressive. They absolutely cause disparities, because the only way for you to gain access to higher paying jobs, to positions of leadership, to a way of making more ways for people to opening up doors in the field of social work is to actually gain social work licensure. And the way you gain social work licensure is to pass one of these bullshit ass tests that everybody knows don't measure shit. And so to try to tell people that we're drifting away from Ubuntu, that we're drifting away from I am because we are, is wild. The ASWB is because we exist. And the ASWB honestly is trying to fight for its relevance. It has no relevance. They are fighting tooth and nail to prove how relevant they are to state regulatory boards. And truth be told, they have none. They don't keep anyone safe. They don't safeguard the profession. They don't protect social workers. They don't do shit but collect our money from taking these tests. For what? States actually have the ability to regulate their own, the way social work is practiced in their own state. They don't need the ASWB to regulate the field of social work. And so when I read this newsletter, and she was ultimately trying to announce there's new research coming out and we all need to join hands to work together to solve this problem and blah 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 the fuck blah. So when I read this, all I can think was, wow, they're trying to fight to prove that they matter when they're being exposed that they actually don't. They're not necessary. They are literally a policing arm of the field of social work that is irrelevant. The field can function without the ASWB. It's just true. The field of social work can function without the Association of Social Work Boards. All they do is provide technical assistance to regulatory boards and administer social work licensure exams. That's it. That's all. That's it. That's all. They are honestly not relevant because they weren't relevant before they became a thing. Like, I'm so frustrated and sad and pissed off. And this is also a reminder, like, all skin folk ain't your kin folk, but it's just when you see Black people that get into positions of power, and I already know how the game go. Most of the time for a Black person to get to the top of an organization like that, you had to sell your soul a long time ago. You also had to be somebody who could be controlled. We know how this shit go. This tells me that Dr. Stacey is likely easily controlled by her board, and or she truly believes this shit. And I just want to say to Dr. Stacey, like, the light is on. If you ever want to come back home, leave all that bullshit behind and come back home, return to this side, not take up the mantle of the oppressor, come home. Things will be lighter and easier and more joyful for you on this side. But to use the sacred principle of Ubuntu, whoo, that's nasty work. That is some nasty work. Nasty work. Because along with Ubuntu, just know, Salabona, meaning, I see you. I see you. So it's more than just I am because we are. It's also some Salabona, and I see you. So I'm going to stop there, and let's go ahead and get into the tales from the trap for the week. So my tales from the trap for the week has a lot to do with, once again, I'm leaning on the wisdom of the young people that I have worked with for a number of years. And the importance of using my power and access as an adult to just bring some joy and ease to their lives. I don't know if I've shared it on you know, the podcast before, but when I used to do office-based therapy for young people that were system impacted, it was a court-mandated program. They would come to my office. We would have our sessions. Also did family work. Also did home visits, you know, all type of things in community and in the office. But my sessions with them would often be after school. This is also a particular demographic where, going to school every day was a challenge, truancy a challenge, curfew a challenge, all of these things. A lot of chaos and dysfunction in their households, a lot of overstimulated nervous systems that just weren't regulated, brains all crosswired, all kind of neurodivergence, just unsettled spirits and bodies, just a disconnection between their minds and their bodies. And so I'm saying all of this to say that one of the greatest lessons I learned while I was actually a social work student in my second year field placement, I was shadowing my field supervisor during her session with a young person. And during the session, that was a time when, I was still in residential treatment. During the session, the entire time, she just let the kids sleep. That's all he did was like take a nap. And I remember being like, well, wait a minute. Like, don't you gotta do the worksheets or do the follow up on treatment plan goals or work towards their projects to be able to, graduate from the program? Like, you just gonna let him sleep? I remember she let him sleep the entire session. And then we talked about the importance, and that was probably of the, how important that actual session was. And how it was one of the best sessions she ever had with that young person, and all the things that it taught her about their relationship and that young person that they were able to fall asleep during the session. And so I'm sharing that to share when my time came, where a young person literally came into the office. And, I had the type of vibe in my office where there's either teenagers, right? These killers, shooters, and killers, allegedly. kidding. These are teenagers. And so, I got different toys and plush animals, all type of shit. But I also had this kind of understanding. I don't care where you sit in the office, as long as you stay in the office. Meaning, if you want to sit in my chair, if you want to sit over there on a beanbag, if you want to sit on a desk, on the floor, I don't care where you sit, as long as you stay in here. And as soon as he got in, like he just went straight to the floor. And then he grabbed a plush animal from the floor. This baby went straight, took a nap. And I just remember sitting there like, oh, it's my moment. It's my moment. He's sleep. He's sleep. And then it dawned on me like, oh, like I'm doing some shit right. I'm doing it right. Like if a kid with, this complex history of trauma, all these things happening previously and currently in his life has decided I'm the adult that he's going to close his eyes, relax his body, and go to sleep. I'm doing something right. And can't nobody tell me shit. And there's no theory, manual, worksheet, anything that could have taught me that I was on the right path. It was an experience I had from grad school, applied to my actual practice, and just believing in the strength of the therapeutic relationship and the trust that I had built with this young person that they felt safe enough in their bodies and safe enough with me to close their eyes and go to sleep. And I do not take that for granted. I do not take that for granted. And then so folks might even wonder, well, how do you even write that up as a note? How do you bill for a client sleeping through an entire session? Easily, you just write that you practice emotional regulation and breathing. And then you review sleep hygiene. And then you send that note right on in and it gets approved. But that particular moment from my time in the trap really just lets me know that I'm created for this work. I'm created to be a soft spot for young people in particular who just have some challenging experiences, some challenging lives, and some shitty relationships with adults to show them a different way that they, in a different way in how they deserve. Right, to be cared for and loved and protected by adults. And so just understanding, and even if you're hearing this and like, oh, sleeping in the session, what type of shit is that? If you can get a client and not nodding off from drugs, I'm not talking about nodding. I'm talking about legit conscious sleep. If a client goes to sleep in a session with you and you just let them fall into a deep sleep, you're doing some shit right. And so trust yourself, trust your gut, let it happen. I'm going to move us into a good Black word, and then we're going to be out this thing. And so the good Black word for for the week is associated with the Olympics. You know, we just closed out the Olympics earlier this week. And I did my best to watch what I could. It was a little bit challenging for me because I don't have cable and I wasn't paying for Paramount. So I watched a lot of the whatever I could see on YouTube. Now, with the Olympics, just in reflection, what it really did for me is like it reminded me how important it is to remember that you do not always win and that fairness will not always prevail. There was a time in our culture where, especially in like competitive sports or activities, where we tried to make everybody a winner. And that's just not how this shit works. Should it be that way? I'm not sure. I think things should be a lot more balanced and harmonious than they necessarily are. Now, should everybody get equal and win the same shit? Too much inequity to answer that. But the Olympics really kind of had me reflecting on like, yeah, like you don't win all the time. And things will not always be fair. And you got to learn to deal with that. And how learning to deal with that requires, you know, these new sets of learned behaviors and skills that have to be taught and transferred. And how many people are lacking, right? The skills to actually deal with disappointment, the skills to deal with not, you know, getting your way, or, you know, routines changing, rules changing, all of these things, shifts in movements. And a lot of people, adults, kids, and otherwise, are missing the skill sets to actually deal with failure. Then that also reminded me that failing is allowed. Failing is always an option. We hear this, you know, failing is not an option. Yes, it is. Failing is allowed. Failing is an option. And I believe failing is actually necessary. Like, I'm a big fan of failing forward. I have learned to enjoy getting shit wrong so that I can learn and move forward. And so really wanting to impart on people, like if you're in this mindset of I can't fail, everything has to go right, I'm a winner, gotta win, gotta be strong, gotta all this stuff, like fuck all that. No, because it doesn't really matter how hard you work and fight and try and all of these oppressive systems that we cannot opt out of. You're not going to win all the time, and things are not going to be fair towards you all the time. So then you do have to grow to be comfortable with failing. You have to allow yourself to fail. You have to let failure be an actual option for you, and have to understand failing is necessary for growth and momentum. Like, use it as fuel, use it as a tool, but like failure is necessary for growth and for momentum. So offer yourself some grace to fail forward, to fail backwards, to just fail, and have enough belief in yourself that you're going to be okay. Maybe you'll bounce back. Maybe you'll bounce into something different. Maybe you'll just be like, fuck it, I don't want to do any of it at all again. All of those options are for you to choose from. As long as you give yourself permission to fail, you're not going to win all the time. And every win is not for you to have anyways, right? How can we learn to celebrate other people's wins while also waiting for our own and celebrate our own wins when they come? But I just want to let you know, like, please, please fail. Hell, I hope you fail. I hope you fail forward as many times as you need to until you get closer to whatever right is for you. And so I'm going to leave it there. I believe that's all I got for us this week. And as y'all already know, y'all, I do hope that you remember to take care of your heart so that we can take care of each other. Because at the end of the day, we is all we got. And y'all, we will chat next time. Y'all be well.